Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we head into the garden with horticulturist and entomologist Roberta Clark. Morning, Roberta.
Good morning, Mindy.
What a wet, cool spring it has been.
It's very discouraging, isn't it?
I know. I mean, it's nice when we see the sunshine, but and I'll just start off with, I've mentioned my dahlia experiment. I did not lift them in the fall. I can't remember why I didn't, but I didn't. And I thought, okay, temperatures haven't been that bad. Well, they're all mushy and rotten. I think one of my 20 made it. So lesson to be learned, you got to dig them up in the fall.
You know, it was probably more the amount of moisture in the soil rather than the temperature, because it rained all winter instead of snowing.
Right.
It seems like this spring, it's just been day after day after day of wet weather. Maybe not downpours, but enough to keep the soil wet.
Yeah. And that has implications elsewhere in the garden.
Yes. I have some lettuce that I put in, and several of them are rotting at the crown. And I haven't watered the garden except the day I planted them. So I'm keeping an eye on that.
Now, and that also, all this moisture is leading to some lawn disease. Are we seeing lawn disease this early?
I have red thread in my side yard. Granted, it's an area that doesn't get fertilized, and red thread is quite common on low fertility lawns. And I know if I go out there and fertilize it, it probably will survive and come right back. But I'm probably not going to do that.
I know. I just let my lawn do whatever it wants.
Yeah. I have too many other things on my list. Right. I was going to work. I had big plans for last Saturday. I wasn't working. I was going to get tomatoes in the garden. I was going to do all this good stuff. And of course, it rained all day. So I had to go out and buy more plants.
I think I did the same thing.
Yep.
Our number for your garden questions or comments this morning, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Seems to be a lot of slugs already. And has that got to do with this moist weather as well?
They love the weather. Slugs and snails are everywhere in the garden, on hostas, on whatever's out there that's leafy and green. And they're doing quite well because it is so moist. So unfortunately, that's just sort of a fact of life this spring. One good thing about this cool weather is many of the earlier blooming shrubs and trees have looked spectacular and have held on to their blooms for much longer than we usually see it. So I'm trying to look for the positive.
It's true. I mean, my azaleas are beautiful.
Yep.
And, you know, I like forget-me-nots, but this year, for some reason, my forget-me-nots are absolutely spectacular. And I don't know why I've never noticed them being that spectacular in the past. Maybe it's because they held on to their blooms a little longer, but they're just gorgeous.
Just lovely. My problem with the forget-me-nots is last year I thought they were quite lovely, and I let them set seed thinking I would just have a few this year because they're sort of annual in this area. And oh my Lord, they are everywhere. And when in areas that I'm not particularly concerned about, not a problem, but when one bed in my vegetable garden was solid forget-me-not, I had to pull them all out.
Yeah, well, that's hard to do, isn't it?
Go
back to slugs for a minute. What do you do for slugs? I mean, a lot of times people use the diatomaceous earth, but it's so wet that, you know, that's maybe not going to work.
It's tough. The diatomaceous earth works by irritating their sort of slimy underbelly and discourages them from going on to different plants. But it does have to be reapplied after rain. And you need to use the horticultural grade of diatomaceous earth, not the pool grade diatomaceous earth. Some people use traps. They will sink like little baby food jars or yogurt containers or whatever into the ground around plants and fill it with potato peelings or other vegetable scraps that are attractive to the slugs. And the slugs fall in, and you also add water to it, and the slugs fall in and drown. I've actually had some luck with that. My sister years ago came up with kind of a nice method. method. She ate grapefruit every single morning, and after she ate her grapefruit, she would take the grapefruit peel, you know, the hull, mm-hmm. and put them upside down out in her garden, go out the next morning, lift them up. They'd be filled with slugs. She'd throw them away and put the new ones that she just ate down.
Mm, there you go. All right, so we have Memorial Day coming up, and that is a date that many local gardeners use in their mind to plant all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. But I have my basil sitting in the inside. I feel like it's still a little too cool at night. I don't know.
The sort of rule of thumb that we tell people is you want the nighttime temperatures to be consistently around 50 degrees. And surprisingly, they actually have been for the past mm-hmm. week. Maybe a little 49 or 48, mm-hmm. But most of the time it is above 50. Even though it feels chilly to us, right. that's adequate. So I'm fairly comfortable with planting things now. As I said, I was going to plant last Saturday. I sort of operate on the principle of I have to do things when I have the time to do it. but I also have aluminum hoops and row cover that I'm able to cover my beds with just in case we get a cold night.
Right.
So I have my sort of ace in the hole there.
Got a backup plan.
Yeah. But I think, and I say this tentatively, I think we're okay now.
Okay, so we can plant anything right now, pretty much everything?
Pretty much, mm-hmm. For the next 10 days, the nighttime temperatures are actually quite warm. Who knows what next week will be, mm-hmm. you know, after that. But by then, we're almost in June, so I think we're good to go.
Good to go.
I am, after the show today, I'm planting my tomatoes.
I have my tomatoes outside on the steps. I've been hardening them off. So, I think they're about ready. Since I've had the basil in the house, I'll have to bring that out and put it on the steps for a couple days, maybe before I put it out in the garden.
Yeah.
That's another thing people like to put their house plants out. I know you do the same thing. Is now the time to start hardening them off to bring them outside?
What I like to do, and I can't do it today because I have other gardening tasks on hand, but within the next week, whenever I'm not working and it's decent outside, I will start taking them out, and I take them out to an area that has dappled light. You don't want to put them in full sun because, surprisingly, plants get sunburned mm-hmm. just like we do.
Yeah.
And I've learned that from experience many, many, many years ago when, as a novice houseplant gardener and my enthusiasm to take my plants out on a fine April day, I put them in full sun and went grocery shopping and came home and they were all burned.
Yeah.
So don't do that.
Yeah. So you slowly bring them out in and out if it's a little bit cool at night, do you just leave them out?
I'm going to just leave them out. Again, mm-hmm. we've got these 50-degree night temperatures, and for most houseplants, including our tropical plants, that's sort of okay. It's not wonderful.
Right.
They would much prefer warmer temperatures, but they're not really going to be hurt that much by it. And again, if you have time to take them in and out, that's great. But if you don't, if you're a busy person,
just put them out there.
You take them out, put them in that dappled sunlight, more shade than sun, and keep them watered, and they should be fine. And then move them out to the appropriate spot.
Right.
I have a number of plants that will go in full sun. They go usually around my deck, but the vast majority of my overabundant houseplant collection are tropical plants, philodendrons, and various things like mm-hmm. that, and they will stay in dappled light, but in different places in the yard.
Yeah, I put mine, like my amaryllis and whatever else I have, I stick them behind my holly trees, and they love that little spot. It's shady there. I think they might get a little bit of morning kind of dappled sun. And I'll go back there in the summer and go, oh my gosh, everything's in bloom.
Yes, they're surprised.
They love it out there.
yep. But it's a lot of fun this time of year. We often feel stressed because there's so much to do and so little time to do it in. But, you know, it's really fulfilling that when we get all our gardening tasks at least underway, mm-hmm. yeah. you know, there's a real sense of accomplishment.
Yeah. It's sort of fun, too, now, because as you going through the garden and you'll discover things that you didn't plant or you didn't plant them there.
Oh, yes. Oh, look. Well, my fine discovery this spring is that many of my hellebores have seeded, and so I have hellebore seedlings coming up in various places, and I find that very cool.
Yeah, I have the same thing with foxglove. You know, you have the foxglove, mm-hmm. and then it goes. It doesn't stay in the area you want it to stay in. You find it all over the place, which
it
is
moves
that's
around,
okay.
Yes.
That's good. My big one was in the back part of my path. I don't have any allium planted there. It's in another section of the garden, but I'm like, oh look. There's one popping up right here. Some little critter or bird or something moved it.
Yep. Okay. I have that experience with bloodroot, which is just an incredibly beautiful native wildflower. And I, years ago, planted the double flowering form, which is just such a choice plant for a woodland garden. Mm-hmm. And the seeds are carried by ants.
Oh, really?
Some distance away from the mother plant. And so I now have in several areas of my yard, I have bloodroot that comes up every year, but it's not the double variety. It's reverted back to the straight species, which is a beautiful single white flower. But it's just so cute to see it springing up, and I know the ants planted it.
I had never thought about that ant. So yeah, we got the birds, we got the squirrels, we got all kinds of help out there in the garden.
That's right. Yep.
All right. Carol in Falmouth writes, I received three particularly dense, beautiful regular begonias 6 weeks ago, and I want to put them outside in a north-facing container in a couple more weeks. What's the best way to keep them blooming so enthusiastically, and how much can they be cut back to maintain their density?
You would want to start hardening them off now, as we just talked about, and then eventually transplant them into their pot that they're going to be going in. If you keep them deadheaded, they will continue to bloom on a regular basis. They also appreciate being fertilized every few, depending on the strength that you're fertilized, once a month if it's full strength, maybe twice a month if it's half strength. If they start getting leggy, cut them back just above a node, which is where the leaves come off, and you'll get new shoots coming from that particular area. They're really beautiful plants.
Yeah, I would say some of the colors on those begonias are just spectacular.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
There's one that looks like orange sherbet that I absolutely love.
And what do you use for fertilizer when you're fertilizing?
I'm currently using a product that I've been using for the past couple of years. It's not 100% organic, but a lot of it is derived from seaweed, and it's called, Max C or C-Max, one of those combinations of names. I think it's Max C, and I use the 16-16-16 formulation, and I use it on my house plants. I use it on my container plants, and I get good responses from it. So I like that. But yeah. You know, any fertilizer of your choice. When I'm doing containers outside, I usually mix in Osmocote, mm-hmm. which is a pelletized slow-release fertilizer, and that keeps a fairly good level of fertility over the course of several months.
Yeah, I do the same thing. Osmocote, I sprinkle that in all my containers as well. The other one that I really like, too, is the Neptune's fish and seaweed fertilizer. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit smelly. But
very smelly.
but it's good. It works. 866-999-4626 is our number this morning for your garden comments or questions. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Gardening This Morning with Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Roberta, I had somebody ask me about the beech tree disease, and I know we've talked about it before, but tell people what's happening to these beautiful beech trees.
Unfortunately, it's a foliar disease that's caused by nematodes, which are like, I don't know quite how to describe them. I hesitate to call them worms. They're sort of microscopic, little tiny worm-like organisms. And They unfortunately have progressed throughout the state and have come onto the Cape in the past several years. And there really is not a lot that a homeowner can do about it. Even the professionals have a difficult time managing this particular problem on our beaches. And it attacks both the beautiful European beach, like the Purple Beach and the Weeping Beach and gorgeous specimen trees. Unfortunately, it also attacks our Native American beach. And we have some beautiful beach that have come back on the Cape. When I first moved here in 1980, you could find pockets of beach in Mashpee and in, of course, the beech forest in B-Town. And now the Native American beech has moved out and is in almost every town. And it's a beautiful, beautiful tree. Leaves are apple green when they come out in spring. What happens is this gets into the vascular system of the plant, and it kills it.
Yeah.
It's slow, but it kills it. And it's sometimes the symptoms are very subtle, but the beech are just leafing out now. And if you are out in a few weeks admiring American beech or your European beech, and you look up through the foliage and the leaves look striped, that's one of the diagnostic features of this particular disease.
So sad, because some of these trees are so old and they're so beautiful.
They are magnificent, yes.
Yeah, very sad. Well, maybe we'll figure out something to do that can cure this. We'll keep our fingers crossed.
That would be nice. Yeah. Hopefully the scientists are working
on it.
And they will come up with something. But it's kind of a difficult problem that has concerned a number of people.
Yeah. All right. Susie in West Tisbury writes, "My gorgeous 35-year-old King Alfred daffodils disappeared this year. I was so dismayed to see only one flower in each of the three clumps. I guess they rotted. They were in a narrow bed along the south sunny side of our house. This is usually a dry bed, but we did have many storms from the southeast this past winter. Question, should I dig down and remove the rotten bulbs?" And then Susie says, "So appreciate your monthly show, and I'm sorry about your dahlias." My own fault, Susie. It's my own fault. So should she dig down and remove those rotten bulbs, or you can leave them?
I would, depending on how much time she has, it wouldn't hurt to get them out, but it's not going to be a real big problem if she leaves them. And I think she's probably hit the nail on the head. Soils have just been so wet for the entire winter and now the entire spring that many things just have rotted.
Yeah. Does this mean with all the water, we may not have any kind of drought issues this summer, or we just don't know?
Well, you know, I think our aquifers are going to be absolutely fine, but our gardens are growing in like the top, the roots are in the top 6 to 8, maybe 10 inches. Trees will be fine, but anything that is shallow rooted can be subject to dry spells. So you have to pay attention to rainfall. Your gardens are still going to need approximately 1 inch of water a week, even though the aquifer is full right now from all the winter and spring rains.
Yeah. All right. Dan wants to know what he can do about rabbits attacking his blueberry bushes. And honestly, it's not just blueberry bushes. Those rabbits are really a pain this year.
Oh, my Lord. C.L. Fanari likes to recommend the liquid plant skid. She feels that is the absolute best rabbit repellent. I've used the granular. That works very well. She has said that the liquid works better. It's not an inexpensive animal repellent, and it's comprised of blood byproducts, mainly pig blood. And it smells, but they all do. It does work very well. So on a blueberry bush, certainly, while they're not don't have fruit on them, go ahead and spray. You don't want to spray edible crops because it does stink. But you could spray around the vegetable bed, and it will keep them out. Or you could spray around the blueberry bushes, and it will help.
I go out and chase them. They see me coming now, and I feel like they're going, "Oh, look out, here comes Mrs. McGregor."
You know, I was looking out in my yard, and the interesting thing is we actually have two species of rabbits here on the Cape. We have the fairly common eastern cottontail, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a good-sized bunny, and we see lots of them. We also have the New England cottontail, which is a smaller rabbit. And it has, you can tell the difference, it has sort of like a little black spot on its forehead between the ears, and the ear appears to be lined around the edge with black. Just a little bit of trivia.
Yeah.
You know, bunnies have been my foe for quite some time, and I use plant skid, I've used scram, I'm now using cheap wire trash cans that you can get at like the dollar store, and when I see my hosta coming out of the ground, I turn one of these little wire trash cans, they're only about 10 inches tall, I turn it over the emerging hosta, and it protects it until it begins to leaf out.
Yeah, boy, they're into everything. Yeah.
Yes, they are.
Rascally rabbits. All right. Carl is giving us a call from Acushnet. Good morning, Carl.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Carl, we got your cobra beans. Carl sent us some cobra beans, which I shared with Roberta and Amy. And Carl, my grandson and I made a support for it this weekend and planted our cobra beans. So thank you so much. That was so kind of you.
It was no problem. Wonderful, Carl, and I loved your method of how you plant them. I'm going to do it in a container, and so I will modify your caging technique just a little bit to fit the container, but I'm thrilled to see how they grow.
Yes, I actually made a new enclosure for my bean, very professional, and I made provisions for 8 foot of height.
Wow.
Before, I only had 6 foot of height, and the beans were growing way over there.
Yeah.
I just germinated some seeds indoors in cups, and in 4 days they sprouted. So
wow.
The seeds are very viable, which is a nice thing.
Oh, that's
and then,
looking forward
to them. As far as enclosures go, to protect from rabbits, all you need is chicken wire and some ferrin, and, you know, make stakes with points on it, drive it in the ground, and then wrap the chicken wire around it.
Mm. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Because without it, like last year, somebody was eating all my string beans the minute they came up. I ended up having to go 6 foot high, also for deer reasons, too.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm hoping nobody's going to, like, mice don't get in because they're the only, you know, 1 inch chicken wire ain't going to let much through.
Yeah.
So, I'm having a good year in the garden so far. My tomatoes that I have started are just flowering, the early ones, so the timing is better. And then I guess one comment I'm going to make is the soils. I took your advice and got Coastal Maine products and premium grades,
yep.
And it's so much better. It's just, it ain't like the wood and chunks of junk you get in most
stuff. Oh, I'm so glad you like it.
Yeah. So, and, Carl, I want to ask you, I want to go back to cobra beans for a minute, because I've never even heard of them before, and they're like about 7 inches long, and they taste like a regular green bean. What's the taste like?
Yeah, and they don't get stringy. I mean, if you read I got them from Park Seed, but if you read the reviews, everybody's saying, I'll never grow another bean again. These are the best beans ever.
Oh, I'm excited.
And they're
prolific. Yeah, I can't wait to try those.
Party plants, and you'll be buried in them.
Yeah. Well, we only made our structure 6 feet high, so we're going to see what happens there. But, Carl, thank you. That was very nice of you. We really appreciate that.
And just one thing about the weather this year has been like rainy and windy. But last year we had 10 days in the 30s in May. We had a killing frost on the 18th. So this year is so much better, and hopefully everybody will have better luck with their gardens.
Yeah. Carl, thank
I
you.
Hope so.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Carl. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Richard writes, a few years ago, I had 3 dozen foxgloves of assorted colors in my yard. They grew to 5 to 6 feet tall. Now I haven't seen them for a couple of years. Very mysterious to me.
Usually foxglove will seed themselves. The original plants, they're biennials. The first year they form a rosette, the second year they form a stalk and flower and set seed. If you cut off the stalks, when the flowers went by but didn't leave them time to set seed, then you will not have seedlings that renew the patch. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the trick with foxglove. You buy them at the garden center, and you plant them, and they will flower the year you buy them because they're basically a two-year-old plant. You have to leave the seeds to develop on the stalk, and then you will see little seedlings come up later in the summer, and you can transplant them at that point, or you can wait until the following year. But if you deadhead it before the seeds form, eventually you won't find any more of your foxglove.
Good point. All right, Denise is giving us a call from Quissett. Hi, Denise.
Hi there.
Good morning.
Thanks so much. I just love the show. It's always wonderful when this is the day it's on.
thank you.
I have had an experience in my garden that I never heard about. Many years ago, 40, 45 years ago, we bought a lovely, very early peony, I think from Avant Gardens. And this year, it started, or I guess it must have happened last year, it began putting out babies.
Oh, how wonderful.
So I know. I mean, I'd never heard of a peony doing that before. Oh. It's got a very open leaf, sort of pomate leaf. It's very early. It's in bloom now. And a gorgeous, deep pink-red flower. And I think I took 5 to the Woods Hole Library book sale this year. I gave one to my daughter. I've got one in my yard that just bloomed. The ones that I gave away are not going to probably bloom for a year or two. But have you ever heard? I wish I could tell you the name, but that's long gone.
I have not heard that, and I'm envious because my peonies don't set seed. Avant Gardens, well, by the way, is for the listeners, is an absolutely wonderful specialty nursery.
Absolutely.
In Dartmouth.
Yep.
I haven't been in a couple of years, but I used to go. My sister lives in Tiverton, and we would meet up and go over to Avant Gardens and spend too much money.
Yeah, they always have really interesting things that you don't expect to find.
And they also have a greenhouse filled with the most unusual succulents mm-hmm. you have ever seen.
Yes.
So it's a wonderful. Catherine Tracy is the owner, and it's just an absolutely wonderful little nursery. If you want to take a drive down to Dartmouth.
Yeah. All right, Denise. Thank you.
I could actually probably ask her when we first started going there. It was just a little bitty place in the back mm-hmm. of their yard.
Yeah.
So it's been wonderful to see it grow. Thanks very much.
Oh, it is. And an interesting thing, I used to go to New Bedford to Alan Haskell's nursery,
right.
And of course Alan passed away and the nursery closed. But she obtained a lot of stock plants from Alan Haskell. So really beautiful stuff.
Yeah. Denise, thanks for the call and thanks for sharing. Maybe somebody else has had that experience with their peony and we can find out what kind it is. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. What do you think about No Mow May?
I have to be careful here. I mow my lawn in May, or I don't mow it, but I have my lawn mow in May. I don't really want it to be a meadow. I don't have a big lawn, so it's not that much of an issue. But we have a lot of plants growing everywhere, not just in your lawn. I don't think mowing your lawn is going to seriously impact pollinators.
Mm-hmm. All right. Marianne writes, is there a good netting for cherry trees and blueberry plants that won't tangle birds?
Yeah, see, that's a real problem.
Yeah.
I have to say no. Any netting I've seen I was using netting on my blueberry bushes, and I was distressed to see birds getting caught up in it, so I stopped using the netting, and of course then the birds and the chipmunks ate all my blueberries. Now I have, it's a a structure I got from Gardner Supply Company up in Vermont, and it's tubes you fit together, and it forms a framework over the bushes. It's 4x8, I think, is the size, and they come larger, and you can use it on more than just blueberry bushes. And it comes with a cover, a very, very, very tiny netting. It's more of a mesh. It's not that thin plastic. Mm-hmm. It's a fatter weave. Is that the way?
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Way. And it has a zippered door that you can open and close. Birds do not get caught in it.
Oh.
Mm. So that's what I'm using, at least on my blueberries right now. Obviously, you could not use that on a big tree.
Right. I wonder too. You know, you hear people talk about, like, in their strawberry gardens, I think they put like little red rocks or little red balls that kind of fool the birds. They go up, oh, and then when the strawberries are in bloom, they go, "Oh wait, that's just a rock," or you know.
I have heard that,
yeah.
And I thought that was an intriguing idea. I saw something similar.
I wonder if you could do it with blueberries. Hang some little. I don't know. I don't know if it would or not.
I saw something the other day where someone was using the small mini balls, mm-hmm. Christmas ornaments that were red, and they hung them in whatever, I can't remember what the small tree was. It was a fruiting tree, but it was quite small. And long before they were bearing fruit, the same principle, the birds attacked the little mini Christmas ornaments and discovered they weren't fruit, and when the fruit was out, didn't come back. So might be worth a try.
Oh, trick them. Right, exactly. All right, Linda is giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Good morning.
I'm calling. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. This is sort of in regard to the person who just called about the blueberry netting. You know, it's so hard because many of us that are trying not to use chemicals on our gardens, you know, try some of these alternatives, and the lack of success just makes you wonder what to do. I had a terrible time with cucumber beetles a few years ago, I always now... They're around, so now I seem to have them all the time. But I bought from Gardens Alive the sticky tags.
Yellow sticky traps. Yep.
Sticky traps. And it seemed like a great solution. I know people that have had success. I hung them out. They pretty promptly got covered with cucumber beetles. But also, I looked out one day, and there was a beautiful, tiny, yellow bird.
Ooh.
Played out with its wings stuck to the sticky tank.
Oh, no.
It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. The wings were so stuck, you know, the sticky tape is sticky. Mm. And I couldn't possibly get it off. The bird was just splayed out there. I thought, well, the predator who was looking for a nice bird meal is going to find this promptly. But, I mean, that seemed to me like such a good method. And yet...
Mm.
I mean, I'm terrified to put it up again because seeing that splayed out bird, you know, whose wings were stuck to the tape, I don't know.
It's distressing when something like that happens. Mm-hmm. You know, the yellow sticky trap. Yeah, the sticky traps work beautifully. I use them indoors on my houseplants to control fungus gnats, which are a big problem if you have lots of houseplants. I have used them for cucumber beetles. You kind of have to hide them down amongst the plant. I don't put them out sort of in the open. They're amongst the foliage, so they're less likely to attract a bird.
Yeah.
And will the beetles find them just quite well down in among the
will.
Plants?
Yes, they will.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. They were hard to find a couple of years, and I, you know, was trying all the sources and couldn't locate them. So a friend gave me one extra that I will put out this year because the cucumber beetles were terrible.
Some of the local garden centers do carry the yellow sticky traps, so you can buy them locally.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're hard to find because people have discovered that they do work really well for fungus gnats, so people use them indoors. And but I know they are carried locally in garden centers.
Linda, thank you for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. It's Gardening This Morning with Roberta Clark. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Dale writes, just wondering if Roberta can give me any clue as to why my variegated willows, about 8 to 9 years old, were not variegated with the pink and white new growth this year.
Mm-hmm.
I love your gardening segments. They cover so many different and important topics. And she also writes, also, I order bolts of heavy tulle fabric for blueberry protection. All right.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Someone had mentioned that a couple of years ago. Perhaps it was this person. And I had forgotten all about that and thought it was a great idea because birds don't want getting stuck in that.
Yeah.
What was the question again?
It was about her variegated willows, yeah. Which are coming, the new growth is not variegated.
Yeah, to get consistently that beautiful pink and white variegation on the dappled willows, it is only on the new growth. And if you haven't pruned them in a number of years, you don't see it. They just revert back to green. So they actually need to be pruned fairly hard in the spring. Mine had all sprouted out, and it was all green, and so I cut them back hard. They haven't resprouted yet, but they will, and I expect they'll be the pretty pink and white. So it's a question of pruning.
Yeah. Since you're mentioning pruning, you know, lots of folks sometimes cut back, like I cut back my asters now until about, you know, once they come up until about July 4th, Montauk daisies. What are some of the things we should be, you know, watching, you know, clipping back a little bit so that they don't get out of hand?
Well, you just mentioned the main ones, the Montauk daisy and the New England asters. Both get very tall, and if they're not in 100% full sun, they also get very leggy and sort of flop over. So I cut back my Montauk. I actually cut it back quite severely this year because it had gotten way too large for the area it's in. So, yes, you can do that. Now, chrysanthemums, the perennial chrysanthemum, you can pinch that back periodically up until the end of June. Much beyond June, you really that would delay flowering too much.
Yeah.
For zinnias, I usually pinch out the very top growth to cause them to branch earlier. So they're bushier. Mm. I grow the Bennery Giants. They get quite tall, so that keeps them a little bit, doesn't keep them short, but a little less tall, and it causes them to branch out, so I have more flowers.
Yeah.
So things like that.
Yeah. All right, Lee in Eastham writes, it's such fun listening to you both talk about all things gardening. Raised beds, yes, one has to buy them first, but then you'll have them. It's an investment, and then forever you'll be so glad you got them. Year after year, you'll be standing up to garden, which is so wonderful, and you can heavily mulch them and then rarely need to water them. Possibly the best feature is you don't get slugs.
Nice. Yeah. I have raised beds, but I don't have the tall ones. Mine are only about 8 inches tall. So I still get slugs. I still have to bend over. my new investment this year, which I'm going to go use once I'm off the air with you this morning, I bought a lithium battery-powered tiller that only weighs 6.5 pounds. And I spread my soil amendments, lobster compost, and bumper crop. And so I'm just going to go out there and till three of the beds. One's already planted, and one's asparagus, and that leaves a couple more that I haven't gotten to yet. And I'm going to plant my tomatoes.
Oh, that sounds good. 866-999-4626 is our number for your garden comments or questions. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Jenny has a question. What is your worst weed? They each have their own worst qualities. My worst weed is bindweed. It's in the morning glory family. Oh, I feel your I have the same thing. That would be my worst, bindweed. Hate it.
Bindweed is really nasty, and if you've ever planted morning glories, sometimes they come back, not as vigorously as bindweed, but it can be a real problem because it tangles up other plants, and it's just kind of a mess. My worst weed is an invasive weed called creeping buttercup. Mm. And when it first appeared in my yard, I thought it was kind of pretty, so I didn't do much about it. And it's around my raised beds in the vegetable garden. And I said, well, it's sort of a ground cover between the beds. And so I would just sort of weed whack when it got tall. Now it's everywhere.
Oh,
and
no.
This year it came up in my asparagus. It came, one bed was almost covered with it. I can't use herbicides. It's my vegetable garden. So I very patiently had to sit on top of an overturned pot and dig out with my gardening spade all this horrible creeping buttercup. Very pretty lacy leaf, beautiful yellow flower, but noxious weed. And so I did weed whack it, and I basically scalped it down to the ground. We'll see if it comes back. If it does, I'm just going to continually weed whack it.
Oh, my goodness. I think I might have, looks like a little, bunches
really?
Of buttercups in my lawn.
Yeah. Well, there are little tiny buttercups in the lawn, and they're not a problem. I mean, they're so small. This is a vigorous plant. Some of the clumps were probably 8 inches across, and it has roots that go way down. And it's a real invasive plant, so I hope you don't have it.
I hope so, too. But so far, not in my garden. It's only in the lawn, a couple of patches. I'll have to keep my eye on that.
Yep.
The bindweed is, I had it in one little section. Now it is pretty much everywhere.
Yeah.
And they have the roots just get down so deep in under everything. You just can't dig it out.
Unless, no, it's tough.
Yeah, you just have to keep pulling it and pulling it and pulling it. And it seems like it never ends.
It's always something, as Roseanne Adana said.
That's right. Going back to containers for a second, I had a friend who was talking about she used the same soil as last year, and then she said something happened to one of the plants in there that looked like something was eating it. And I said, I don't know. Is that the soil? I often use the same soil for a couple of years. I might like freshen it up on top. What do you do with your containers?
The same as you. I used to, every year, dump them out onto my raised beds and till it in as organic material and use fresh soil. That got very expensive because my containers that I grow in are large. They're not small pots. They're big pots. So now I use the same soil, but I do add either lobster compost or bumper crop and use my spade and mix it in the pot. So the amendment is mixed all the way through the soil. And I find over the years, the soil, you pull plants out, you pull weeds out, you're pulling soil out. So you're renewing the soil over a period of years.
Yeah.
And it's less expensive.
Yeah, exactly. And also, too, I find that sometimes I get things popping up in there that I didn't, either I didn't plant or they're seeds from a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And so there's always these little surprises that kind of pop in with whatever else I have in there. So I'm always curious to see what's going to come up. We mentioned the slugs earlier, and now people are going to start putting their tomatoes, and they're going to be worried about, all kinds of, critters, and bugs and fungus and everything. So what do we want to do to protect in the vegetable garden?
Well, I think, being observant is probably your first task. Obviously, you're spending time out in your garden. You're working right up close and personal with your plants, and you're observant, and you can see when things are starting to happen, and you can see what is going on. If you find insects you're not familiar with, you could take them to the master gardeners at the Extension Service to have them ID'd. I used to always tell folks your forefinger and your thumb are your biggest tool. You can squish things. These days, there are a lot of organic remedies on the market. My main go-to is Cap'n Jack's, which is spinosad, very safe to use. It only attacks a metabolic system in insects that is not present in birds, in domestic animals, in humans. So it only works on insects. So, but being observant and hand-picking and squishing are probably your first line of defense.
Right. And then when you are going to use something, even spinosad, you want to follow the directions.
Follow the label directions. Yes. The label is the law, actually. A lot of people don't realize that. But if you're using a product inconsistent with the label, it's technically illegal. I mean, you're not going to have plant police come out and arrest you, but, you know, it is, you do need to read the label so you understand how to properly use the product.
Right. And then one of the things, I've been hearing a lot of folks, and everything is expensive, right? And the price of everything has gone up. And I feel for some of these smaller garden centers who, you know, I mean, their costs are going up as well. So it's really hard to, you know, stay on your budget, especially when, like you say, it's a rainy day, we can't garden, we'll go buy some more stuff, right?
Yes, so it's a good time.
Yeah, it's a good time to reach out to your garden friends and see what they've got a little extra of, and you know, maybe trade off with some of your friends to add to your perennials.
Yep. I work at a garden center, but I also travel around the Cape. I never met a garden center I couldn't stop at. And we have a lot of larger, beautiful garden centers on the Cape. We also have a lot of smaller garden centers. You know, basically, maybe they have a specialty crop they're growing. So I like to patronize local, small horticultural places as well as the bigger garden centers, and it keeps them in business, and they may be growing specialty plants that we don't find elsewhere.
Right. You learn a lot. Right, let's talk to Janet, giving us a call from Falmouth. Hi, Janet. Janet, are you there? All right. Don't have Janet. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Just got a few minutes left. Let's try one more time. Dan, do we have Janet? No Janet. Okay. We'll come back to that. It's hard. I think as you get along gardening, it's easier to pull out those perennials. But sometimes it's just, you just have to do it. Otherwise, things get overrun and you end up with a lot of chaos, like my garden.
You should see mine.
But yeah, it's hard. And so now if you have some, neighbors or friends who are beginner gardeners, you can
share
some of that bearded iris, or I would say, don't take the lily of the valley.
Oh, no. Yes, that's my downfall.
I'm so sorry I ever took that.
Well, you know, I it wasn't bad enough that I took pink flowering Lily of the Valley. I then found Lily of the Valley that had golden stripes on the leaves. So
really?
I had to plant that, yes. And then I found another Lily of the Valley that has a gold edge along the leaf. So I have three different kinds of invasive Lily of the Valley in my yard.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's some of the stuff we don't, you know, you think Lily of the Valley, you know, your grandmother had it in her garden, you don't think invasive, but there are a lot of plants that you want to avoid because they are invasive, and you can find lists. I think the Cape Cod Cooperative Extension, they have a list of invasives, right?
There are. Lily of the Valley isn't on the state list, I don't believe, but there is. The state has a list of invasive plants. And they have a fairly strict criteria by which they evaluate these plants. So something that lands on this list truly deserves to be there. And yes, it is available online, and you could get the link to that through the Cooperative Extension.
Right. And invasive or just a pain, right?
Well, so, aggressive.
Aggressive. There you go. Lily of the Valley, aggressive. All right. One listener called in and said, beer for slugs. I think you've used that in the past, Roberta.
You can put beer in little containers and sink them in the ground. As I think I've said in the past, I prefer to drink my beer. So I use potato peels. I think they work just as well.
All right. Roberta Clark joins us the third Tuesday of the month through the gardening season, and I'm sure we'll have lots to talk about next month as things really get underway. Roberta, as always, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.